Laura Zabel. I'm the executive director of Springboard for the Arts, which is based in Minnesota. We're based both in the urban area of the Twin Cities and also in a rural community called Fergus Falls, which is about an hour east of Fargo. So we have both an urban and rural context for our work. And our work is all about helping artists make a living and a life through programs like entrepreneurship training and healthcare and other direct services, and helping communities better tap into the resource of their artists. So partnerships with community development agencies, other cross-sector partners, and a program called Community Supported Art that's based on the community supported agriculture model. And we do that work all sort of driven out of this idea and desire and vision for reciprocal relationships between artists and communities. So communities where artists are visible and valued for the contributions they make, and where communities know how to find and call on and engage with their artists for the creative thinking and practical skills that they bring. It's kind of hilarious to me that I am here talking about evaluation, since it is not something that I necessarily would have characterized as a strong suit of mine or of Springboard's. but through some of our work in placemaking and community development, we have sort of stumbled into, fallen backwards over some measures that have turned out to be incredibly useful and practical and meaningful to our partners. So the project I'm going to talk about today is a project called Irrigate. It's a project that we've been doing in St. Paul in the Twin Cities in partnership with the Twin Cities Local Initiative Support Corporation. My colleague Eric Takashita is here at the conference, and also with the city of St. Paul. This is our mayor here, Mayor Chris Coleman. And this program, this project, Irrigate, was really born out of the idea that every neighborhood has artists and that those artists are a resource to that neighborhood. But sometimes that resource needs a little bit of water, a little bit of tending, to really make those connections that make it easier to tap into that resource. And it was also born out of great community challenge and crisis. We are building a light rail train in the Twin Cities to connect the two downtowns of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And of course, the hope and the expectation with that kind of big infrastructure development is that what comes along with it is increased vitality and economic development and connection and all of the things that we want our communities to have. The reality of living through 4 years of this kind of intense construction is incredibly difficult if you are a small business that is trying to make a go of it. If you are a neighborhood that has a very real historic reason to be worried about displacement, this train provides almost a perfect parallel to the development of the Highway 94 corridor that went right through the middle of and divided our historically African-American neighborhood, as the interstate did in many, many urban centers. And so there were a lot of fears surfaced in the neighborhoods and a lot of very real challenges to both businesses and neighborhood identity. That picture on the bottom is our building where our office is. And there is a lovely wine bar and coffee shop called the Black Dog in the bottom of that building, though you cannot see it because of all of the construction. So it was also really born out of looking around our own neighborhood and observing the challenges and the struggles that our neighbors and business owners were having. The lucky thing about a big challenge like this is that we think this is the kind of challenge that artists are particularly adept at helping with. Artists can see the opportunity in this disruption, they can see the beauty in the chaos, and they have very real practical skills that can draw people and attention and dollars and interest to a place. And so together with our partners at the city and LISC, we created Irrigate. And Irrigate has multiple strategies, but the one I'm going to talk about today is this idea of how do we deal with a persistent negative narrative in the neighborhood. So when you have that kind of huge construction and a reporter talks to a business owner and says, how's it going? The business owner says, It's awful. It sucks. No one can see my door. They can't find where my business is. There's a huge traffic jam. There's a ditch in the middle of the road. And that's all true. And that goes in the paper. And then I read that in the paper and I think, oh, that's certainly not someplace I want to go. That sounds horrible. And so how do you address that kind of negative narrative, whether it's construction related or whether it's a neighborhood that is dealing with crime or any of the other sort of negative reasons that we get in the paper? So how do artists address that? How do we mobilize artists? How do we provide an invitation and a charge that really helps artists participate and engage with that challenge? We started by holding one-day workshops for artists. We taught these in partnership with the community organizers from the place-based organizations all along the corridor. And the only requirement to come to this workshop was that you had to be willing to call yourself an artist and that you had to live, work, or have a significant relationship with that neighborhood already. So we put a high premium on local artists who are already in the communities and a high premium on reaching out beyond the sort of usual suspects of the art community and really attempting to have this be a project that was about a community surfacing its own creative potential rather than importing it or dropping it into a community. So artists attend those workshops. After you complete this one-day workshop that is really about basic community organizing skills, how to listen, how to do a one-on-one, that kind of stuff, you're eligible for a small amount of project funds to do a project. The only requirement of that project is that you have to have a partner that's a business or a neighborhood organization. So essentially someone along the line who wants you to do that project with them. We are about two-thirds of the way through Irrigate. It's designed to be a three-year program. And we have had about 600 artists attend the workshops, and 150 of them have created these small projects. So what we learned from that is that the demand is really there, that artists want to participate, that people want to use their creative skills for the benefit of the place where they live. But we also learned that you need mechanisms to make that happen. You need to be able to provide the connection point. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what those projects look like, because that's really the fun part and the interesting part. And then I'll talk a little bit about what we learned in terms of the impact of this kind of work on the community. So 150 small projects. This is a project that the puppet maker Chris Lettergardella made for that Black Dog Cafe that's in the bottom of our building. It's a two-person puppet that roams around the neighborhood. So if you can't see your sign, then maybe you take the sign to the people. I think this is a really great example of the way artists can look at a challenge and see an opportunity or see a different path through that challenge. There are also a number of projects that were about just intentionally placing artists' work in businesses that needed support and needed attention and people. So these are a series of performances at My Village Restaurant, a restaurant that was really struggling during the construction, and a restaurant that reports that because of these performances, they saw a 40 to 50% night-on-night sales increase every time they hosted an artist. And a restaurant that has now gone on to have a monthly jazz night and to really engage with the local artist community. There are also projects that just helped people find their way through the mess. So this is a series of bikes designed by Carrie Christensen that were locked to public infrastructure and had information about how far it was on bike or on foot to various neighborhood amenities to other shops in the neighborhood. They were also projects that help people kind of think differently about their place and about their ownership over a neighborhood. This is a project by the artist Amanda Lovely, who designed this really big table and set it up in the middle of downtown St. Paul and invited people who work in downtown St. Paul, who spend a lot of time in downtown St. Paul, to think of that as a neighborhood and to sit down and have a coffee break with each other, have coffee and cookies and do some drawing and chatting and just sort of reframe or change a little bit of how people perceive the place where they spend a lot of time. This is a project that we did with a new business who had rented this really key corner piece of real estate in a development that had recently gone up. But they knew that to build out this restaurant, it was going to take about 9 months. And so normally when we build a restaurant, we put paper on the windows and it says coming soon. And then about 4 months later, those papers are all yellowed and they start to fall down. And everyone in the neighborhood kind of wonders, is that really coming soon or what's happening there? So instead, this business worked with a group of artists and they commissioned a rotating set of temporary murals. The project was called Make It Mysterious. And so every 6 weeks, the murals would change. So people had a sense of momentum that there was that there was animation on that corner and that things were happening and that things were progressing. I use this one as an example of how, you know, this is a very simple, very low risk way of working with an artist. These are paper murals that come down every 6 weeks. But it was an on-ramp for this business. They hadn't done a lot of work with artists before. And then coming out of this, they commissioned several artists to do work inside the business, more permanent work. And that really was a lot of our goal, was to provide these easy, low-risk opportunities for people to have the experience of working together. And so we're really encouraged when we survey all of the collaborators on all of these projects. 90% of them say they're more inclined to work with an artist again after having this experience. Some of them were much more about engaging residents and neighbors in speaking out or in having agency in their place. This is the artist Kristen Murray, who declared herself artist in residence of this bus stop for 2 weeks and spent that time participating in neighborhood activities, participating in citywide initiatives like the citywide cleanup day, and also helping her neighbors map their neighborhood in alternative ways, like by flying a little camera up in the air on helium balloons. Sometimes they were projects that were about a gift to the community or a gift to a business owner. This is a flamenco troupe that did sort of like Christmas caroling, but instead of singing songs, they did flamenco dances in convenience stores and fire stations all up and down the corridor, just really more as a gift to those business owners, as a sort of bright spot in their day, rather than specifically to drive attention or people or an audience. There were also projects that addressed vacancy and tried to call attention to places that needed some love. So this is a old historic theater called the Victoria Theater that's been vacant for many years. And the artists Nick Clausen and Aini Asian Dance did a project where he made a video that he then projected on the facade of the theater while the dance troupe danced live on the sidewalk. So literally a reanimation of a vacant space. The beautiful thing about this project, or maybe my favorite part about this project, is that the audience sat on the construction. So we sat on the half-constructed tracks. It was a two-night performance. It was sort of under the radar. I have showed this slide when I've given this presentation with people from the Transit Authority, and they don't love that we did this, but we didn't, you know, we did it and got out of the way, and nobody fell in the ditch. So sometimes these projects were a little bit, we characterize these as naughty, not illegal, but just sort of fun interventions. And the thing about that sort of magical experience of sitting in a construction ditch, watching this beautiful performance on a sidewalk and watching people drive by and stop their cars and get out to see what was happening, is that you can't drive by this theater now and not remember that and not have a different relationship with that place. And there's actually now a group of neighborhood organizations and theater companies that are in the process of buying the space to renovate it. This is a project called the Light Rail Shuffle by the artist Diana Lane. She's a dancer and a Zumba instructor, and for her Irrigate project, she taught a Zumba class at Arnella's Bar on University Avenue, which is the street that is the main corridor. And then she wrote this song called the Light Rail Shuffle, and it is a happy, fun, joyful song that has a hilarious Zumba dance that goes with it. It is also a song about how 94 destroyed the Rondo neighborhood, the historic African-American neighborhood, and her desire to not get left behind this time. And I think this is another example of how artists can bring a different lens to things, how artists can help people find a voice and their own agency. Does this project solve the historic inequity of that interstate construction? No. I want to be very clear about that. But it does give Diane and the people who participate a different way of expressing their voice and their agency in the situation. The other sort of lovely happy ending of this story is that the Light Rail Shuffle has become kind of a cottage industry for this artist, and she gets hired now to teach the Light Rail Shuffle at events. This picture on the bottom includes a whole bunch of people doing the Light Rail Shuffle with Diane, including someone from the Regional Rail Authority, the business owner's children, and several artists from the neighborhood, as well as a couple people from Springboard. And I think that's that kind of social bridging, that kind of shared experience does begin to change the social capital and the social fabric of a place. This is a project where an artist went to the St. Paul Farmers Market and interviewed people about recipes that they were going to make based on the things they were buying that day, and then illustrated them and brought them back to the market for people. So sometimes they were performance, sometimes they were visual art, but often they were these sort of small interactions between people that kind of reframe how people think about things. This is a recent project where a group of artists, including Aaron Marks, collected people's wishes on an open streets day. So people were walking up and down the avenue, and they just had a box where you could put in your wish for yourself, for your life, or for your community. And then they printed those wishes on fortunes and put them, worked in partnership with a whole set of Asian restaurants along the corridor, and put those fortunes in the cookies. So people who went to those restaurants would receive someone's wish from the community, and they also projected them on the side of a building of one of the restaurants. This was one of the very first projects, and it's called the Chained Glass Project. It's the artist Steve Bougie spent several weeks installing these tiny pieces of stained glass in a chain link fence. There's a journalist who described this as the broken windows theory in reverse, that the idea is that if you see these moments of care and tending in your neighborhood, how does that change your own perception of your own agency, your own voice, your own ability to take action about something you believe in, and your own responsibility to care for the place where you live? And I think this, you know, this project is really designed to be the sort of moment of joy and surprise for people who are stuck in traffic, for people who are walking by, and has really become sort of a beautiful symbol of our whole project of Irrigate in general. So we've done 150 of these kind of projects. They're all beautiful. They're all amazing. I could stand up here for hours and show you pictures of amazing artists who have come to this work as neighbors and as artists who have brought tremendous fierceness and dedication and joy and love to their neighborhood. And I have a million stories about the beautiful relationships that have developed between business owners and artists, between artists and each other, the way that this has sort of given people a common cause to come together and to address something. None of that feels like a metric. It's all important. So when we first started Irrigate, we started the whole evaluation question. Well, first we started by sort of pushing back against it and saying, that's not who we are and it's not what we want to do. And then we sort of got over ourselves and decided, well, we do really need to figure out how we're going to measure this. So it was a big project. It had a lot of investment in it. And so we took a developmental evaluation approach, which means that we started just by listing all of our kind of assumptions and hypotheses about why we were doing this. And what were the issues that we saw? What were the challenges we saw in the neighborhood that we thought we might be able to help address? And one of those really was the narrative, this issue of the self-reinforcing narrative, both about the construction, but particularly for some of the neighborhoods, an ongoing negative narrative that existed before the construction as well. And we didn't really know how we were going to measure that, but we knew that that was an important piece, and it was certainly an important piece to our partner in the city. And to the community organizers that we were working with. And as these small projects started to roll out, we started to notice that they were in the paper a lot. So we started collecting every time there was a media mention about one of these projects, every time there was a story. And then we kind of observed that there became a tipping point where the story was no longer about us, about Irrigate, but it was just about these projects, that all of these hundreds of little projects gave hundreds of different kinds of media outlets and different kinds of reporters a reason to cover this. So there were stories by traffic reporters, there were stories by the City Beat reporter, there were stories in the culturally specific newspaper, there were stories on public radio and in the mainstream media. And so we just were collecting and collecting and sort of observing that this had really taken on a life of its own. And we got kind of to a critical mass of this collection of media mentions. And we started looking at them and really sort of had this light bulb moment where we realized, oh, this is a narrative. This is a narrative. This is a story about this neighborhood, that all of these media mentions together collectively essentially make up an alternative positive narrative. So then it was at that point that we thought, oh, we better find someone smarter than us, someone more experienced than us to tell us what this means, because it seems like it might mean something. So that's what we did. We commissioned a study from a group called Tunheim that is an expert in PR and marketing and media. And they did an objective study that told us a lot of information about what that narrative has meant. So the top line finding is that what that narrative meant was 30 million positive media impressions about the Central Corridor during a time of incredible distress and challenge. They were able to divide those 30 million positive media impressions by type of media, so newspapers, radio, online, TV. And just as a point of comparison, I'm still, you know, this study is brand new and we're still, I think, being able to untangle pieces of it and figure out some ways of comparing it. But one particularly notable comparison, I think, is here. If you can see there, during this time period, there were almost 17.5 million media impressions in the newspaper alone. During that exact same time period, coincidentally, there was a marketing company that was engaged by the city to help address business mitigation. And they spent almost exactly the same amount of money on advertising, so paid media, not earned media, and generated 5 million media impressions in the paper. I think there's a lot to be mined about the way that people differently perceive earned and paid media. But just at that very top line level, I think you can make an apples to apples comparison to something that people, cities, spend money on all the time. They were also able to look at it over time and see, you know, there was a seasonality to these that, you know, is a seasonality that we have in Minnesota in terms of people's willingness to do or engage in projects that are outdoors. They were also able to divide it up by where the stories were about. So this was particularly meaningful to our partners in the place-based organizations to be able to go back to an organization like the Frogtown Neighborhood Association that we'd worked with a long time and say, there were 3.5 million positive media impressions about your neighborhood alone that specifically mentioned your neighborhood or a project or something great that was happening in your neighborhood. And particularly in that case, you know, the organizer has said, you know, this is a neighborhood where we're in the paper because something bad happens. So to find a tool that we can use to generate positive coverage that is about authentic, real things that are happening here in our neighborhood is incredibly meaningful. Tenheim was also able to do a sentiment analysis of the sort of character of these stories. And I think it was particularly exciting for us to learn from the study that the coverage of these projects and of Irrigate was 100% positive. So the thing that I think made this possible was that it turns out we spend all this time trying to get arts reporters to cover our things, but it turns out that the City Beat reporter needs a story to write every day. And if someone got arrested, well, then that's a story. But if there is a giant puppet of a black dog walking around the neighborhood, that is also a story. And both are true. And it is just a matter of seeding the authentic, real experiences that are weird and interesting and fun and give people a different story to write about that place. And I think that also begins to change people's perceptions of the place, both the people who live there and their perception of what's possible. And of course, then the readership who may have different idea about why or when they might visit that neighborhood. Tenheim also added to the sort of more numbers-based analysis a whole set of stakeholder interviews with sort of gatekeepers and other people in the community. So this is a quote from one of those interviews from a woman who's the policy director for the City of St. Paul. And just for me, it's incredibly meaningful to see somebody who works for the city describe this process as the magic of art. I think when we started this project, there were a lot of people, both in the public and private sector outside of the arts, who were like, sure, that sounds cute. Whatever you want to do. And the more that we were able to articulate the impact on the narrative, the more that they were able to just observe it and see it and feel it, the more it became a real core strategy for the city and for the other stakeholders who are engaged in trying to address some of the challenges around the construction. And I think that this study is also particularly meaningful for some of our public partners because of that comparison I made earlier, because they're used to spending money on things like branding for business mitigation or branding for cultural districts or branding for, you know, neighborhoods. And so to be able to provide an alternative that says, not that those things are bad, but you can spend that same money You can spend that money by putting it in the pockets of the people who actually live in this neighborhood and who are engaged in and participate in this neighborhood. And you can have a better return on investment in terms of changing the narrative and people's perception. That's been really exciting. So that's sort of the local impact of it, or the meaning that it's had to our partners locally. But then so what? So there was an alternative positive narrative in the paper. Does that actually meaningfully change people's perceptions? Does it actually change anyone's behavior? It turns out there's a whole body of research about that that I certainly never knew about before this, but we're just at the beginning stages of investigating. So really starting as early as the early 1960s, this guy, Bernard Cohn, who is a policy researcher, political scientist at the University of Wisconsin, developed something called the agenda setting theory of the media. And it really is a theory about how the media affects not only people's perceptions, but their actions and eventually policy decisions. And there have been over 400 academic studies about the media's function in agenda setting. One thing I have also discovered in my research is that some of those academics could probably use an artist to help them with some more attractive infographics. This is the best graphic about the agenda setting theory. There were many, many others that have many more arrows and are many much less coherent, at least to my eye. The thing that I think is interesting about this model, about agenda setting theory, is that, of course, there is this sort of logic model theory of change that influential media leads to a media agenda, leads to a public agenda, leads to a policy agenda, which, of course, that's exciting for us to see in and of itself. But maybe more interesting to me are these sort of external factors that say that doesn't happen in a vacuum. So essentially say you can't just place a bunch of articles and change people's mind about things. It has to be reinforced by their actual personal experience. So when they come to one of those events in the neighborhood, does it feel, in fact, like a fun, interesting, exciting place where things are happening? And other people's perception, what they're hearing from other people. And I think particularly now what people are hearing on social media, or how that story in the media is reinforced by reality, which again, I think is another reason to focus on the local, to focus on experiences that really do come out of the community, that really are authentic representations of people's work and hope and dreams for their place, and that are reinforced, that are actual events for people to go to. So it isn't just a story about how a neighborhood's turning around. It's a story about something to do, to go and experience that neighborhood and to be there in the place. So again, we're just sort of at the very beginning of figuring out what this means. And so I'm sure there are people in this room who know more about this than I do and have ideas about this. But I will say that for us, as an organization doing this work and who works with a tremendous amount of artists and is always sort of challenged to quantify the value of our work, this has been an incredibly meaningful process and an incredibly meaningful tool, and one that I'm particularly excited about because it feels real to me. I can actually count these things. They're very tangible. And it makes, like we talked about in the first session, it's reinforced by logic. It makes a sort of logical sense when we talk with our partners about it. And it's also a place where there is a tremendous opportunity, I think, for us to partner across sectors. It's a challenge that many, many neighborhoods and geographies and communities face. And it's a challenge that there aren't a lot of people working that effectively on the question of narrative and how that affects people's agency. So already, I wanted to talk just really briefly about two other places where we're kind of taking this same strategy, because sometimes I show all these and talk about this and then people say, well, I'm not building a light rail. I'm like, well, it's not really about, we didn't build the train. And in fact, this irrigate really has very little to do with the actual physical construction of the train, and much more to do with the neighborhoods around it and the social fabric and the way that people are either engaging or thriving or able to change along with their neighborhood. So we're working on a project in our Fergus Falls office around the redevelopment of a historic property there. There's a It's a historic mental hospital called the Kirkbride. It's nearly 750,000 square feet of vacant space in a community of 13,000 people. So a narrative challenge, as well as another kind of, a lot of other kinds of community challenge. And the challenge of the narrative there is really that it's become a very oppositional narrative. So there are people who really, really think this building should be preserved because it's a beautiful historic building, so you can't tear it down. And then there are people who say, you have to do something. You can't just leave this amount of vacant space. And what could a community possibly do? So we've engaged in a series of small projects that are artist-driven, partner across sectors, to change people's idea of what's possible there. Again, it isn't our intention to be the ones who redevelop that space. It's our intention to change people's idea of what's possible and what the narrative is about that particular challenge, but also in the narrative, like we talked about earlier, that we hear or read about rural communities and their vibrancy and energy. We're also doing a project right now with the Asian Economic Development Association around the development of the Little Mekong Cultural District in St. Paul. So this is a place where I'm particularly excited about the opportunities here, because I think that doing lots of little projects can very easily reinforce the identity of a cultural district like that. So by giving people very real street level experiences that reinforce that this is, in fact, Little Mekong, it does feel like that when you go there and there are things to do and see that make that identity visible. I think there's a lot of potential there. So I'm happy to take any questions or thoughts or places where you've maybe observed this kind of momentum or change in your own work.
Hi, I'm Howie from the studio here. And we do a lot of projects that are site-specific and on more of a permanent basis. The one thing that we struggle with is, as you said, you have 100% positive media representation of your projects, of those narratives, which...
And 100% positive media reinforcement of your projects is really important, really great in sort of changing the narrative of the communities you work with. But I wonder, for you as a commissioning organization and one that wants to improve the way that artists, integrate and interact with those communities, where do you get critical feedback and how do you, as an organization, assess the internal success of your selections and choices?
It's a really great question about where do we get critical feedback and how do we assess the projects sort of from a more internal perspective. I think there's two things I would say about that are perhaps unique or make us an outlier in that regard. First of all, there's no curatorial piece of this. Anybody who wants to do a project, who goes to the workshop and finds a partner, you get to do a project. Because the outcome that we're looking for is not about the art as object. It is about the process and the relationship that's developed and a neighborhood's ability to express their own creativity. And so in that way, it's kind of it makes it easier. I will say that there is this really positive narrative in the media about the projects that are about, here's a thing to go and do, here's a thing to see, look at this weird performance that's happening in a parking lot. We have had, I'll be very frank, quite a bit of pushback from some of our peers in the arts community around issues of quality, around whose definition of artistic quality we're working with. And I think that's feedback we take really seriously, but we're also pretty intentional about why we're doing this. And so it's useful feedback, and it's prompted a lot of useful conversation and investigation, but it is also, at the end of the day, less important to me.
Mm-hmm. What's that relationship about? How long was that engagement before the project manifested itself? And just a little bit of history.
Sure. So the question is about how we built all of these relationships. And this, all of our work is really partnered. We do a lot of work across sectors in healthcare, in education, and community development, and local food. But even in that environment where we're really used to working with a lot of partners, this is maybe the most I mean, sometimes I feel like this is like this crazy blob of huge numbers of people with different agendas and ideas. There are a lot of individual humans and a lot of entities involved in this project. So the three core partners, LISC and Springboard and the city, really co-designed the project together. And so this project wasn't a thing we thought up and then took to them and said, do you want to do this with us? It was built out of existing relationships we had and conversations we were already having about how we might kind of bridge some of the opportunity between community development and particularly artists. And then, you know, I think it's also really important to say those place-based partners, the district councils, who co-teach the workshops with us. There's six of them involved in this project. And some of them we had existing relationships with, and some of them we didn't when we started this, but we knew that that was really critical. And so we paid them to be our friend. I think now they are our real friend, but at the beginning, they're small organizations, and it was important for us to go to them not saying, will you spend two Saturdays a month teaching a workshop with us? Because you're going to get a lot of great projects. But to say, will you spend two Saturdays a month teaching these workshops with us? Because you're going to get a lot of great projects, and we're going to pay you for your time because we know it's valuable. So I always mention that piece because I feel like, you know, sometimes the idea of partnership is best born out of long-term relationship and really human partnership. And sometimes it can be transactional, and that's okay too. Yes.
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in how you get ownership or sense of ownership from your community partners. A lot of what you're describing
is a form of public art. We manage public art for the state of Rhode Island. It's the most controversial thing that we do and sometimes the most challenging thing that we do because everyone is a critic, and particularly people when you're slapping a mural or something on a wall in their neighborhood can be quite vocal in opposition to it. So I particularly like the fact that you require a business to be a partner with an artist, but I wonder where some of those challenges might occur.
Yeah. So it's an excellent question. There's a couple ways, again, where I feel like we've totally cheated in this regard. The first is that they are public art, but almost none of them are on public property. They're all in partnership with private businesses, neighborhood organizations that own that property. And so in that way, there's a whole set of kind of regulations that we just don't have to worry about. But in terms of people's reaction and ownership, I do think it's in the relationship that we, you know, the artists do go, it's a short training, but it is a training about community organizing and how to really understand and listen to a partner, how to really figure out what somebody else needs or wants. And then they go and find that partner. And then a lot of times the projects are co-created. So by the time the project happens, there's already been a person, the artist, who, you know, has a significant relationship with that neighborhood already, who's saying they want this to happen. There's a business owner or neighborhood organization saying, we want this to happen. So then even if you don't like the art, it's hard to get around the fact that people wanted this to happen. I will say, I don't want to sort of gloss over some of the challenges. I could put together a whole slideshow of projects and talk to you about all the weird challenges and failures. The place that's been the trickiest for us, particularly in the business artist relationship, is that our city does have an ordinance around signage. And so they can't, around murals especially or permanent installations, it can't really have anything to do with the business explicitly, and it certainly can't have their name on it, which if you're a business owner is really what you want, someone to paint your name really big on the side of your building, especially during the construction. So that's been a place where we've had to kind of work through a lot of relationships and try and help people understand that policy a little better. The other thing is that these projects are so small, and we were very intentional from the beginning about wanting them to be low risks, that if something has to come down, it can come down. It's not such a big investment of financial resources or anybody's time that if there were something really problematic that we couldn't just say, well, we're going to take it down. I will say, out of the 150 projects, we've only, I think, even talked about removing two of them. So, we were willing to take that risk, I guess, is what I'm saying. Yes.
So it sounds like that it wasn't a permanent process for any of the work since it was all private property.
My name is Renit. I'm from University of Maryland. So it sounds like there wasn't any kind of permitting process necessary for any of the work because it was on public property, private property. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
Yes. I would say the role that the city has played in this project has been hugely instrumental, sometimes in helping us figure out, you know, some of the live stuff, you know, performances on the street and flash mobs and stuff they do need to think about. But the city has been really, really helpful in figuring out when they need to help us figure out that process and when they need to say, yeah, you should do that, and I don't want to know about it, which is, you know, the benefit of really having a city that's bought into the project and is really engaged in the project.
So then my second question is where your funding came from.
What a good question. It's all privately funded, which is another thing that in terms of places where, you know, it can get caught up with sort of controversy or push, we've always been able to say that the city is a partner, but they don't have any money in this project, which is particularly useful to be able to say when, for example, an artist designs a project outside of an adult bookstore. So all private money, both local and national. The first funder was the Central Corridor Funders Collaborative, which is a really, I think, exemplary collaborative of funders in the Twin Cities that was put together to address exactly this, to address the challenges and the opportunities that come along with this kind of big infrastructure investment. So it isn't the collaborative that paid for the train, but they're figuring out how everything else works and how to have a collective impact around the conditions around the train. And then we were lucky enough to be an investee of Art Place in their first year. And that really was the support that made this possible. It made it possible for us to commit to this at the scale we've committed to it and to the length of time. Yes, in the back.
Practical questions. One is, what happened at those workshops? Can you say something more about that? And then what was the funding? How much did you give to the artists to do their projects?
Sure. The workshops are sort of a placemaking 101. So just looking at a whole variety of kind of creative placemaking projects from all over the country, kind of open people's idea of what this work can be, how their work might fit into that frame. Some really practical and tangible information from the organizer about the challenges and opportunities that exist in that neighborhood that they care about and are interested in working on. Some exercises that really are kind of out of the community organizing 101 playbook, how to sit down and do a one-on-one conversation, some personal leadership style. We do a big part of it is that we do this activity called the observation tour that my colleague Peter Hogan Thompson designed and leads, where people go out into the neighborhood and kind of look with new eyes at their place and look at some of the overlooked or undervalued places, you know, alleys and parking lots and just sort of reframe how they think about the place. And we end up with some information about how to go forward, how to design the project, how you might approach partners, and what the process is for that. Coming out of that, then the artists really are in charge of going and finding the partner. If they need help, they have access to the organizer and to us, but most of them do it on their own. They have t-shirts, which helps a lot. Gives people an idea that you're part of something. So they go and find a partner, and then they come to study hall, and they get peer feedback on the project from other artists and from the organizer again. And then they're good to go. Each artist can access $1,000, and you can work on your own or you can work in teams if you have a sort of bigger project. So very, very small. And the whole process is designed to be simple and low risk. We were very intentional about not framing it as a grant. It's a project support, and there isn't the curatorial piece, and there isn't some mysterious process by which a panel decides yay or nay. You come to the study hall, you get the peer feedback, and you go. Yes.
Hi. Thanks. I love this. I'm really curious in terms of changing the narrative, like the internal and external narratives about neighborhoods and what you've found after all of these media imprints and reports and whatnot. Like, how are the conversations in the neighborhoods changing, and what are your tools for gathering that?
I think the main tool we have for that right now is the relationship with the district councils, with the community organizers. And one of the sort of most moving things to me that one of the organizers said is that he used to feel like his job was to drive things into the embankment, that was really the only power that you had at a neighborhood level, was to stop bad things from happening to your neighborhood. And because of these projects, he feels like now they have these productive, positive ways of moving things. And so, just from an anecdotal perspective, I find that really moving and exciting. So I think, you know, in the conversations with them, in the conversations with the business owners and the neighborhood organizations, we've done some tracking about how many of those relationships continue. So how do they continue to do that kind of work, either with the artists they worked with through Irrigate, or just are they more confident in their own ability to reach out to artists and do creative projects in the future? I think there's a whole sort of vein to be tapped around people's own perception of their place and sense of what's possible. And I have a real sort of gut intuitive sense about that, but it's a piece that we haven't really been able to get those same kind of tangible metrics around, which is part of why I get so excited about the media thing, because I feel like it kind of provides a proxy for that. It isn't the same thing, but it's a way, it was sort of our way into that piece.
What was your book for the Knight Foundation?
Well, St. Paul is one of the 8 Knight communities. So they have a long time relationship with St. Paul, and their whole focus is around informed and engaged communities. So this process of engaging community members and artists in a big community change was a good fit for them. Yeah, they've been really a great partner. One last question? Oh, good.
Where did you get to come up with the name Irrigate, and did the mayor spray paint that?
Yes. Yes. Irrigate really came from this idea that this was about feeding what was already there, that it was about watering the seeds and the momentum and the energy that was already in place. I have said many times that I'm not sure I would again name something that so easily rhymes with irritate. that being said, I think the metaphor has been good for us. And we actually, we sort of expanded that metaphor to think about another kind of agricultural metaphor I use for this project a lot, is that we could have taken all of this money that we raised and built a French garden down the middle of the corridor, and that would have been much more visible change. It would have been beautiful and fantastic, and everyone would have been like, oh, great, it's gorgeous here. And then it would have died, because that doesn't grow there. Instead, we really focused on the native grass, on the prairie. And so that has really strong roots, and it's going to last a long time. That's our theory of change. It also looks kind of scrappy. And you know how sometimes people plant a prairie grass in their front yard, and then they have to put that little sign up that says, hey, it's native prairie grass. It isn't just that it didn't mow my lawn. And that's what Irrigate does. We kind of provide the frame to say this is all about tending what's here, about the natural growth, and about feeding the roots. And yes, indeed, that is my mayor spray painting a stencil on the wall. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.